we all agree on the interpretation that we have given previously in class, namely that disciples like the unjust steward of the parable of Luke 16:1-9 ought to be prudent in determining what their goal is, and the goal is eschatological for disciples, and using their material possessions in such a way as to realize their eschatological goal. Now let's begin with evaluation in the light of the New Testament, essentially. Before we go to that, let me call attention to a couple of books that have come to my attention. One is, in fact, I mentioned this one before, Ronald Snyder's Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, Biblical Study. Ronald Snyder, S-I-D-E-R, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, a Biblical Study. And then Gene Maddox called to my attention this book by Birch and Rasmussen, our old friends, The Predicament of the Prosperous, and it's a series on biblical perspectives on current issues. And by the way, there are other books in this series. One, for example, is a book on the gifts. Another is a book on a committed marriage. Another is a book on how God deals with evil. Another on the inspiration of Scripture, etc. This one, The Predicament of the Prosperous. I haven't been able to read this with any care. I glanced through it. I've looked at this one much more carefully. But this second one does seem to have value. I'll be alluding to this first one in terms of some of the things he does as we proceed. Now let me ask you, what was your decision with regard to this general truth? By the way, what kind of application now are we working with? With regard to the three types I mentioned in connection with this passage, namely direct application, or specific application, or adaptive application. What kind are we working with here? Now, if it's adaptive, it means that the truth is cultural, and you have to adapt it by looking for the underlying truth, and then relate it to the situation. Primarily for Old Testament, although it's true of some New Testament truth as well. Specific. Now, when you say specific, that means that you're implying it's transcultural. But the transcultural truth is general, and it has to be applied specifically, concretely, to given situations. Now, let me ask, is there anyone who deviated from that?
Transcultural?
Yes.
Maybe that was the wording of it, but I had to deviate at the point where it says, in using material possessions, honest what you basically as a means for realizing your eschatological goal of being receiving the God in your meditation. So that seems to come down as work.
It wasn't the intention of that statement to indicate any works righteousness. If one uses those the means, possessions as means in that sense, it's only as a result of faith and the operation of the Holy Spirit, etc. It carries no merit. It's not a works righteousness in the sense that it's humanly initiated, that it earns what these eternal habitations, but rather it's the expression of faith. We need to begin now by asking, if it's transcultural, why is it transcultural? And one of the key statements I would call attention to is Matthew 25. Now, if you interpret the statement I made as works righteousness, I think you have to interpret Matthew 25 in precisely the same way, because that has to do with the eschatological judgment, with Jesus as the judge. And you may recall story there about the dividing of the people between sheep and goats, and the basis on which the division is made has to do with whether or not one feeds the least of Jesus' brethren and as a result feeds him. So that the basis is here is works. For example, it's saved to those at his right hand in 34 following, come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. And I was in prison, and you came to me. mistake we made is where Christ should live, so is this one.
It was interesting because I went all the way through it and had all the evidence laid out and had it figured out and had determined that it was transcultural. Then I went back and read the thing again and decided that it wasn't.
Well, I came out and where she did is, if you read it that way, there's a possibility of being correct. But if faith is the starting point rather than unfaith, then it's not what happens. Because faith is the basis by which we do it.
Now, you must recall that when we talked about New Testament themes, overall themes, by which we evaluate certain statements, that the assumption was that you were justified by faith. Now, I don't think anything that Jesus teaches, and any interpretation I would make of Jesus' teaching, would be based on anything else. It would be based on justification by works, by works righteousness. So I think it was a matter of your interpreting the statement in a certain way, and I assume that faith was behind it. Here again, you have to imply certain things, and anybody interpreting the statement has to infer certain things. You can't include everything in every statement that you make. So you don't repeat over and over again if you're justified by faith, but that's underlying the presupposition of professing truth. So what you did was to misunderstand the statement. You didn't get at the implications that lay behind it. But anyway, I didn't mean that. But if I had meant works righteousness, of course, then you would have been accurate, not only in terms of what's cultural, but actually you would have had to challenge the interpretation of it. Because that interpretation would not accord with Jesus' teaching overall and with scriptural testimony overall, meaning that it was justified by faith, not by works. So. If you interpret it in that way, then you're really not making an evaluation of it. You're making an interpretation of it which is unbiblical. Okay, so you're really saying this is not the proper interpretation of the parable. It does not accord with overall biblical teaching. I'm just analyzing it for you just to indicate where the problem lies. Yes.
I took down exactly how we interpreted that in the past that day. But then I paraphrased, put it in less words. And I don't know if this helps anybody else, but I said, the way I understand this statement is that material possessions are not an end in themselves. They should be used in order to help Christians realize their goal of eternal life.
That's instrumentation. The steward said, I know, I have it in order that. Jesus picks up at the end of the parable. Okay, now, if, understanding now the meaning as we've interpreted it here, if we have understood it as transcultural, what is some of the evidence besides what I've cited here in Matthew 25?
The rich man Lazarus.
Okay, in the very same chapter. Very significant element in that chapter by way of teaching the very same thing. Yes, Jim?
23, Matthew 6. Jesus talks about almsgiving in secret and the rewarded by your Father. Your heart is where your treasure lies, and the appetite for treasure. Matthew 6:33, heart and intentions are involved in stewardship, belong to God as well. Stewardship is kingdom oriented.
All right, very good. And in some cases, you have the negative element emphasized. For example, at the end of chapter 6 there, the emphasis on not being over-concerned or anxious about what you eat or what you wear, food or clothing. So that's involved, too, in terms of attitude toward material possessions, even those material possessions you don't have, along with those that you do have. And he really addresses those who have them by talking about not laying treasures up on earth, but laying treasures up in heaven where the rust and the moths can't get at and the thieves can't get at the treasures. Okay. Any other passages? Todd?
In Luke 18, it tells
all right. The injunction to the rich young ruler is very apropos here. Anything else?
Sending out a disciple on a speaking mission. You know, he told them not to take so much with them. He goes up and share with you where the food is. The name of that one. Not
taking
anything with them, but
depend
on others.
All right. At least don't take two of certain things.
Right.
When they need one of certain things, and then depend on others for food. All right. So that his concern, for example, Matthew 10, the ordination sermon, is that they do certain things, that they take certain courses of action with regard to material things as part of their discipleship and apostleship. Anything else? Yes.
I'm not sure. 1 Timothy 6.
What's the emphasis there?
The emphasis on not putting your trust in riches, putting your trust on that which is true and which is God, and being liberal with the riches that you have on yourself.
All right, that's a very interesting passage in 1 Timothy 6. Yeah, 6:10 is what's involved. There's great gain in godliness and contentment, for we've brought nothing into the world, we cannot take anything out of the world, but if we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. And that's interesting for two reasons. One, he indicates two necessities, food and clothing. Now, there are many other luxuries that a person might have had in those days. We've mentioned just two. So two necessities, and not only that, but with what we have with regard to those two necessities. So he says, in effect, be content with your necessities, essentially. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, to a snare, to many senseless and hurtful desires, to plunge men into ruin and destruction, destruction for love of money, the root of all evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced their hearts with many pangs. By the way, that calls attention to a number of things. One, a number of teachings in the Gospels with regard to the dangers of riches, being rich. It's more difficult for a camel to pass through a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to pass through an eye of an eagle. The emphasis on covetousness, and the rich fool, the covetous fool, and the emphasis on covetousness throughout the New Testament, and of course it's picked up from the Old Testament, from the Decalogue, in fact, and the emphasis there to a large degree has to do with wanting things, coveting certain things that your neighbor has. In fact, covetousness really goes back to wanting material possessions, acquiring material possessions, and not letting anything stand in the way of getting those possessions. Either it means disobeying God, harming other people, etc. Todd?
Another one.
Okay. What is the other one?
I have a question about this one. Luke 19, the parable of the human.
You have some absolute statements of that sort. Now, I say absolute, they're absolute in form, but the question is, as you say, one of interpretation, there could be the use of hyperbole in some of these things. And so the statement isn't as absolute as it sounds, but you have that kind of thing in several places. And by the way, that's picked up in the Old Testament, where you have the emphasis on lending without interest. But you have that kind of thing with regard to this matter of lending to whoever wants to borrow from you, lending almost upon request, and then doing that without any expectation of return. Now, as I say, there are a number of problems in that sort of thing. We talked about them in conjunction with the concept of love as an absolute, you may recall. And there are some who think that these statements are really absolutes. For example, give in Matthew 5:42, give to him who begs from you, do not refuse him who would borrow from you. That's absolute. Well, I lived in New York City for quite a while, and you can't you can't go down the street without being confronted by all kinds of handlers. And, you know, if I took this kind of thing absolutely, I'd fill my wallet, and by the way, I'd leave home an hour earlier, and just go like this, you know, as I walked from Grand Central Station to the seminary where I taught for 21 years. Yeah. Well, at least I do that until I ran out. Almost ran out. But so, the question is whether these are really absolute statements. I say some take them as absolutes. Or whether they're hyperbolic and therefore not absolute, or in some other way relative statements that are general but not absolute. That's the question you have with regard to interpreting these things. People have wrestled with the interpretation of these statements and come up with different conclusions. That's why you have, for example, with regard to Sermon on the Mount, many different interpretations of Sermon on the Mount, particularly with regard to its relevance. And I indicated some of them to you. For example, the dispensationalist takes this kind of statement absolutely and says this has to be the millennium. Otherwise, you wouldn't survive if you were doing this in a sinful society. You have to do this in a society where there isn't much need. I'm not sure how it's relevant. But in that case, anyway, that's the point of view there. So that's an interpretive matter. But this involves the problems you get into, namely the interpretive circle in this, you say. The same thing you get into in interpretation, namely when you try to get at the evaluation of something, here's the truth you're trying to evaluate, and you have to evaluate this in the light of New Testament truths, particularly, but other truths as well. What you end up with is a whole series of texts with which you're working. And to do the thing in some ideal way, you'd have to stop and interpret each of these texts. So the whole process, you know, of interpreting each text in each case. And then you'd say, well, in light of these meanings, then I can evaluate this text in light of these texts, which I've interpreted. But that obviously is impossible. I mean, in some cases, you have to wait 5 years before you did anything about the truth. You're studying, see, and that might get you into trouble. So that's impossible. But I should say, on the other hand, one ought to be aware of this problem. I'm glad you are aware of it, Todd, because this is a very serious problem. And, of course, the more one interprets biblical materials, then the more one has a backlog, a reservoir on which one can call. So the problem becomes less serious as you move along. And by the way, what you're really moving toward in this process, beyond the kind of evidence that you look at in interpretation, you look at scriptural testimony. In fact, what we've really found is that a number of these passages were the very same passages we looked at in interpreting the parable, aren't they? So you begin doing this kind of thing in the interpretive process, and as I say, even there you meet the hermeneutical circle. You do more of it in evaluation. You do most of it in, I would say, in a formal sense at least, in what we call correlation or biblical theology. So what I'm really saying is, the more you move toward biblical theology, the more you've studied various passages and have begun putting those passages together, the better able you are then to do this sort of thing without getting caught up in interpreting materials whose meaning you don't know, and perhaps assuming wrong interpretations, and thereby wrongly evaluating the passage you're trying to evaluate. So this is also to say, then, that all of these things are really interdependent in many ways. You are working with a circle, which we've said about methodology. Methodology is not linear, really. It's more circular or cyclical, so that very often you have to move back and forth between these things in order to do the job that needs to be done with regard to these various facets of methodology.
One way is Revelation 3:14-22,
which
is, I think, the church deficit regarding the well. Yeah.
All those same words, Revelation 18.
Yeah. You have a number of statements in the prophets about judgment, particularly with regard to wealth that is ill-gotten by oppressing the poor, by defrauding the poor, by some kind of stealing, etc. In fact, you have the same kind of thing in James 5 with regard to employers who in fact exploit their employees and become wealthy thereby. They're going to be judged in the day of judgment. So that you have many, many statements that indicate that how one uses material possessions, how one gets material possessions, one's attitude toward material things, all of these have a bearing on one's salvation ultimately. And it comes in both testaments. Okay, have we done enough with that part of it to indicate the methodology of it?
I have a question concerning scriptures that may take another point of view.
Okay.
For example, Luke 6:20 says, blessed are the poor, the rich. Now, what would I do to involve this passage in my study or my evaluation? Should I do this, take passages that involve the opposite end of this kind of economic issue?
In what sense is that the opposite end?
Well, in the sense that these guys, it's not concerned with money in the actual spending of money for the kingdom. It's more of a statement of, well, here's what I put, that money is not the sole factor that deals in the kingdom or in its stewardship. But Jesus makes a statement about the poor, that theirs, they have a place to come to. And I just wondered how do you put in the passages that are...
Are you asking yourself that Luke 16 was 5 to 4? I mean, the poor, obviously, you mean rich and true.
I guess that's not what I'm
asking. And secure eternally.
I'm not asking that. That was one of the first passages that came to mind. Well, how does that apply when Jesus says, blessed are the poor? Because they're not rich.
As if you're saying, you don't need to be proven to that. You're trying to correlate.
I guess. I'm just asking you a question. What do you do?
Let's have some more dialogue on this. How do you react to this?
Well, I see the big interpreter problem is what it's for. Just having food and shelter, Paul talked about Timothy. Is that for, or is it one step beyond that? If I don't have food and shelter, quite what I need, then I'm for. You know, that's a relative statement when you look at that in the world view. You know, if you want to relate that to the world, we are definitely wealthy, even though we don't have necessity.
I would call attention, for example, to the story in Mark 12 of the poor widow who came and put in two copper coins, which gave a penny. All the disciples said to her, they said, "You, this poor widow, has put in more than all those who are contributing the treasures they all contributed out of their abundance. But she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, her whole living." So on the one hand, I would ask, is a poor person a person who has nothing? Not necessarily so. It could be so. On the other hand, it could be a poor person who has very little. But even the very little that poor person that poor person has responsibility for with regard to the kingdom, as was true of this widow.
Now that's also evident in Acts 3, where the community were selling their possessions to help the needy of the community.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I got from that is stewardship is broader than money.
Oh yes.
And that's how I correlated this Luke 6:20, Mark 12:41, Acts 3:1, with the rest of it, is that Jesus is not simply talking about money.
Well, when he said material possessions, we weren't limiting it to money.
That applies to everybody, not just to people who have abundant material.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's talking to these disciples, most of whom probably didn't have much. Okay, so it isn't a question of how much you have or don't have necessarily, although if you have absolutely nothing, then the only thing that would be involved would be your attitude toward even what you don't have, And what we looked at in Matthew 6, I think you call attention to it, has to do with the fact that if you don't have anything, you shouldn't be over-anxious about that. Because you ought to trust your Father to supply your needs if you seek first the kingdom. And by the way, Sider's understanding of that is that that kind of statement is made within the context of a sharing community. In fact, I call attention to that possibility the other day. If you're a member of the Amish people, for example, you don't have to worry about whether or not you have food. Your fellow brothers and sisters will take care of you. And it may be that Jesus was operating there within the context of this new people of God that he was creating, who would share with those in need, as they did in the book of the Acts. So, or as he indicated would be the case with regard to those who lose their families, they'll end up with many more brothers and sisters. He will take care of them. And he indicates that, for example, in Mark 10. So it may be within the context of that that he's talking. No, we're not saying either that it's only money that's involved when we talk about material possessions, or that only the use of material possessions, money, and other things are involved in your eschaton, in your eschatological outcome, because other things are involved too. All we're saying is that one ought to use whatever material possessions one has, if one has material possessions, in such a way as to achieve your eschatological goals.
I guess that was the motivation. That it goes beyond material possessions
and economics
to who's controlling our heart.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Example,
by all means. Yeah. Well, that would be involved in eschatological goals. In other words, of course, one could misconceive those eschatological goals, and in fact, some interpret them wrongly, I think, and as a result, think the parable means what I don't think it means. But if we're thinking of eschatological goals as being with God, as, by the way, the parable at the end of Luke 16 indicates, being in the presence of God is over against being separated from God, then, of course, that's your motive. So, yeah, we're assuming that it isn't merely what you do with your material possessions quite apart from what you are within. No, we're talking about this dual ethic we've talked about. In other words, see, all of the statements we're making are in the context of the framework that we've set now already. Remember the whole discussion we had about New Testament themes, and particularly the ethic of love, Christ-likeness, etc. So I don't see any conflict between those things. They're just various aspects of the same thing. Huh?
In passing, whatever's yours, regarding that, the attitude necessary to support the between him, could we get anything from an antithetical statement that would say, curses are the rich, for theirs is not the good?
Well, here again, I think you have to ask, what does that imply? Is it the riches themselves that are the problem? Or woe to you who are rich, who keep your riches to yourselves, as the rich man did at the end of Luke 16. Now, the implication may be, you see, if you're rich, that means you're not using your material possessions for the reason for which you ought to be using them. Which was the case, as I say, with the rich man at the end of Luke 16, or with the rich fool, you know, who was trying to gather things for himself only. No, I don't think there's any statement to the effect that you're cursed simply because you have wealth. You're cursed if you do not use whatever you have, whether it's wealth or not, for the proper reasons and proper ends. I think that's the idea. As a matter of fact, if wealth itself had been the thing that would have brought judgment, then of course Jesus would have said to the rich young ruler, you're rich, you can't have eternal life. Okay. But the question of what you do with the riches you have, and the assumption is there, I think, that statement, that you hold on to your riches and refuse to use them for the sake of others, for God's sake. Yes, as a matter of fact, there, that's a good passage to call attention to, because the assumption there is that you may have within the church those who are rich and those who are poor. The only thing is, they ought to look them at themselves, evaluate themselves in spiritual terms and not in material terms. So, he says, let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation, and I assume he means, and the rich brother in his humiliation, knowing that his riches fade away. His riches are passing, rather, of course, the holy brother has riches, spiritual riches, and therefore he is exalted. So I think there the implication is that a rich man could be a member of a kingdom, although I think the implication, too, of James is that the riches should not have been gotten by exploitation of the poor, on the one hand. How you get the riches is very important, and how you use them is very important. As a matter of fact, I was interested in, let me call your attention to this, I was interested in Sider's quotation of Wesley in his book on pages 172, 173. He's dealing with the issue of how much should we give? Should we congratulate the Christian millionaire who tithes faithfully? John Wesley gave a startling answer in one of his frequently repeated sermons, but on Matthew 6, 19 to 23, lay it not up to yourselves treasures upon earth, etc. Christians should give away all but the plain necessaries of life. That is, plain, wholesome food, clean clothes, and enough to carry on one's business. One should learn what one can, justly and honestly. Capital need not be given away. Interesting. But all income should be given to the poor after one satisfies their necessities. Unfortunately, Wesley discovered there's not one person in 500 in any Christian city, quotation mark, who obeys Jesus' command, but that simply demonstrates that most professed believers are, quote, living men but dead Christians, end of quote. And then he goes on to say, Wesley lived what he preached. Sales of his book often earned him £1,400 annually, but he spent only £30 on himself. The rest he gave away. He wore inexpensive clothes, dined on simple food, and he said, if I leave behind me £10, you and all mankind bear witness against me that I lived and died a thief and a robber. That something? That's a convicting statement, isn't it? Put it on a Wesleyan. See how un-Wesleyan many of us Wesleyans are. How un-Wesley-like us Wesleyans are. Okay, now our time has gone rapidly. The next step I think one might take, since this is a general truth, and this applies to other general truths, is to ask ourselves, are there specific implementations of this in Scripture which are transcultural? And you might, in fact, also ask, are there specific areas in Scripture to which this general truth ought to be applied, which again are areas which transcend cultural differences? So, when one moves toward specific application, and we're still in the realm now really of both interpreting and evaluating, one asks, are there in the Scriptures specific implementations that are suggested, which in turn would need to be evaluated to determine whether they are transcultural? Are there specific areas to which the general truth ought to be related, which, again, are transcultural? Now, we've mentioned some of those, by the way. The poor, if you apply this, the poor ought not to be exploited. In fact, you ought to feed the poor. By the way, the non-exploitation of the poor, you get in Amos very strongly, in James 5, feeding the poor, Matthew 25, the whole ministry of Jesus, although the feedings of the 5,000, 4,000 would be particularly apropos. The matter of preaching the good news to the poor, which, of course, Jesus indicated to came during Luke 4, and the Great Commission, the evangelization of the world, using material resources for that purpose. Fatherless, widows, strangers, healing the sick, contributing to poor churches. And you know that Paul did that quite a bit. Inviting the poor to banquets, Luke 14. Lending without expecting any giving return, as Todd indicated, Luke 6. Using resources to build the tabernacle and the temple, which means places of worship and for worship. We have this whole business of tithing. Ought that to be a specific implementation of this? Gleaning, the Old Testament. Jubilee year, sabbatical year. The Jerusalem model, which was really a communal model, as the side indicates, Christian fellowship meant unconditional availability to and unlimited liability for other sisters and brothers emotionally, financially, and spiritually. And by the way, he argues that the reason why the experiment, the grand experiment, didn't work was not because there was something wrong with it, at least intrinsically, but because there were too many poor people who came to Jerusalem for various reasons, particularly with regard to the festival that took place in Jerusalem, and as a result they were overloaded and couldn't take care of them. So what he's arguing for really is the fact that there's a unique situation there in Jerusalem because of the thing that breaks down, which was not necessarily repeated elsewhere and need not necessarily be repeated elsewhere. And then we talked about a carefree attitude toward possessions, almsgiving, being content with necessities, etc. We have a number of things biblically which are specific implementations of these and indicate the specific areas in which these things ought to happen. Now, I think these became clear, didn't they? The various practices like tithing, gleaning, Jubilee year, when, by the way, that was the 50th year, all property reverted to the original owner. In the sabbatical year, every seventh year, for example, all debts were canceled, and by the way, the person was warned not to refrain from giving a debt during the sixth year, just because, you know, one more year and it's gone. You know, those are the specific limitations. Then the areas would involve economic areas, spiritual areas, personal areas, communal areas, various areas of these sorts. And by the way, you could broaden this label to physical, to include the whole matter of the healing of the body, an area of concern, etc. Now, if I may just say this before we move on to our discussion, continued discussion of this tomorrow. You see what a job you have before you, trying to evaluate each of these to find out whether it's cultural or transcultural. Take the matter of tithing, for example. This is one example. That's quite an area to evaluate, isn't it? Is that a New Testament practice or not? Now, I saw a smile on Dave Cosby's face when he talked about gleaning. I think there, immediately we realized that gleaning had to do with an agricultural society. And, you know, if you tell somebody in the inner city, or even, some of us have land so we can use the land, but if you tell someone in the inner city, you know, leave some of your produce there so the strangers can come along, the poor can come along and help themselves, they laugh at you because they don't have any place to glean. So that's a very cultural kind of thing. But tithing need not be cultural. The question is it New Testament? And I'd just venture to say to you that I don't think it is. Really, the only place in the New Testament that tithing is mentioned, has to do with those places where it alludes to the Old Testament practice. But there is no emphasis in the New Testament on tithing as New Testament practice. Therefore, I think it begs to differ with bumper stickers which say, if you love Christ, tithe, anybody can honk. which, by the way, is a form of legalism. Or with many ministers of many churches who argue that tithing is the basis on which we ought to give. Now, tithing may give us some guidance, but I'm talking about some kind of legalistic standard, as it was in the Old Testament. And there, it was a legalistic standard. You didn't give 9.5, and you didn't give 10.5, except for certain free will offerings that took place when God did special things for you and you wanted to express your appreciation and give a free will offering. But basically, it was 10%, and that was it. I don't think that's transcultural. I think the New Testament overrides that, overrules that, indicates other concern, higher concern. And by the way, I think that for most of us, it means more than 10%. So I'm not trying to gainsay the amount. You know, I'm not trying to say 10% is too much and I want a little less. That's why I say it isn't transcultural. I think one ought to go higher than that. In fact, Sider talks about graduated tithing, which we might talk about tomorrow, which I think has some merit to it. But it isn't a legalistic application of that old covenant standard. So this is quite a job in itself, which we can't take the time to do. But at least it indicates the kind of thing one could do and should do to do this kind of thing properly.
I mean, the word tithe comes out of the root of
in Donovan?
Right.
Yeah, Donovan. Or the theological, it's the word study. You're talking about the word, okay. Okay, yeah. Put out by Donovan, but it's not Donovan's second meeting. What does he say? Well, that is good then. Okay, does this give you some insight into how you go about this process? I'll tell you what, give me your papers. I'll try to take a glance at them and get some idea of what you've done. That may help me in what we do tomorrow. And then I'll have them in your hands tomorrow for your use, if I'm not able to do everything I need to do. So hand them in as you drive back. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow then.
When I think of specific applications, I think of things that I'm going to do.
That's what we're moving towards, I think.
Okay.
But we're still in the process of evaluation. And we're asking, here now the general truth, which is transcultural, but you have more than the general truth in Scripture about material possession. You have specific ways in which they were used, you see. And that may give you some guidance with regard to its application of your own experience.
But we don't need to pull out just the way the Scriptures apply.
No. But if there are some things in Scripture that are transcultural, then we ought to use those things, you see. Or at least we ought to do something in those areas.
Yeah, that's a good start.
Yeah.
So I'm going to grin and wing because Dr. Poppins has three horses. And Paul Wall has 40 acres in corn that he just harvested.
Yeah.
And Dr. Poppins and I spent all day Tuesday morning out there gleaning the edges of the field where the picker didn't pick.
Yeah.
About 6, 7, or 8 bags of corn for these horses.
So you would classify yourself as a fatherless, a poor, or a stranger.
Trina, I have a question. Final assignment again. On the first overall survey, is that just the chapter or is that the book as a whole?
Well, the first part would be the book as a whole.
Okay.
Then, at least the segment as a whole, although you might want to pick up the larger unit in which 14 is found.
All right, yeah.
For the second one, then you do detailed observation on the third part of it, and then the interpretation.
Okay.
Yes. Bring this upstairs, you know, that's the first thing, and I have to turn it on because there's no point in bringing it up without turning it on, and then I have to turn it off, and I imagine I have some conversations on these things that ought not to be there. So, I remember two steps this time, third one still to come. Okay, let's return to what we were doing with regard to Luke 16, 1 to 9, and indicated that in this particular case, as particularly as we think about valid evaluation, we need to evaluate not only the parable from the standpoint of its general truth, but also certain specific implementations that we find in scriptures. And we have to indicate, or ought to indicate, areas of implementation that are suggested by scripture. Now, we won't repeat the kinds of things we had down here, but you recall the various kinds of things we had down here, Jubilee year, sabbatical year, tithing, gleaning, almsgiving, giving to the poor in the churches, etc., etc. Now, the second step helps you to get some idea of areas that you might analyze and to which you might apply the truth, although there might be other areas that are not suggested here, with regard to its implementation, that are suggested by the scriptures themselves. All would involve a very personal kind of thing. Your own attitude toward resources. Do you worship mammon or don't you worship mammon, for example? Your own, the matter of how, are you carefree with regard to physical needs, as Jesus suggests one ought to be, Matthew 6, following food and clothing, etc. The second would be the matter of the church, the community. This would involve not only gifts to the poor churches, but also what Sider called the Jerusalem model, as it's spelled out in the book of the Acts, the communal model where they shared and took unlimited liability for what the church did on the basis of availability. And then social concerns, which have to do with what you do to the poor and what you do in other areas, what you do, for example, with regard to evangelism, etc. These would be social concerns. So you get some idea of areas in which these truths could be applied. Now, I wish we had more time to deal with this whole matter as to which of these are cultural, which of these are not cultural. But the process would be the same as this. But we can't do it because it's too time-consuming. Let me ask, do you have any problems or questions about the process of these with regard to the kinds of things we mentioned yesterday, and we didn't mention them all by any means. Okay, let's move now to situational analysis, and with regard to situational analysis, we could spell out various areas, and we'll need to make some choice here with regard to which areas we want to, or which area we want to focus on. One could do situational analysis with regard to three facets. Analysis of ourselves, our own situation. Analysis of needs to which we might contribute. And then an analysis of means for contributing to these needs. One really needs to analyze all three areas to do it properly. And these with regard to three areas which we could spell out, namely personal and familial, family kinds of things. And by the way, we carry out the four phases in each of these cases, if we were to do it properly, namely in terms of historical analysis, motivation analysis, for example, how do I spend my money, how do I use my resources, and what are my motives in using my resources, and this would involve budgetary analysis, that kind of thing, for example, you know, how much did I pay for my last car, and why did I buy that car, or another car, etc., and circumstantial analysis. And then implementation analysis, but what are the alternatives? So we'll simply call these the four phases as we do them all. So you have this area. Then you and you see this corresponds with this kind of thing. And then a second area, as you look at the situation, would involve the Christian or the communal area. Correspond to this one, or we hopefully call it ecclesiastical. And here again, carried through on the four phases. And then the third area might be called socio-political. Which in some ways corresponds with this, although we, of course, are dealing on a broader scale with regard to political entities, which was not the case with regard to Israel. Its primary concern had to do with its members of its own people, although the church was concerned outside its own membership. And under this, you could look at local socio-political entities, such as the city, state, at national areas and then at international areas. And here again, you have your four phases to work with. Now, I didn't try to get some reading of what you did, but let me ask, which of these interested you most, these three? Which they're overlapping some of them. Where did you focus your attention? That's like if we answer. How many focus your attention here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, that's most of you. How about here? 1, 2, 3. How about here? 1. Okay, this seems to have the most here, and so let's focus our attention here, and then but we'll pick up certain things elsewhere as well because there is overlapping. Are you clear now on what we've done here? This helps you to see aspects of the problem, as over again simply having no guidelines and shooting at this with buckshot, you know, you can go in all directions. Here it gives you some focus to zero in on. Now, to save time, and because the historical doesn't play as significant a role here as it does, for example, here or here, as you might understand, actually, in a sense, the historical element involves your own history, what's happened to you in the past, what's brought you where you are. It's very interesting, but not as significant in this area as it is in this other. Let's begin by working with motivations. Did you analyze yourself and your use of resources as to what your motivations are? And let's be completely honest here about it, because if I hear all good things, I will have some problems with this. All of our motives are not good. Okay, what are some motives that are at work in this area in regard to use of personal resources. And what is that bias?
We're just in an affluent society. Our idea of poverty is a lot of affluence.
And what does that do by way of providing motivation? All right, let's put that down. We tend to confuse luxuries with needs. Now what, again, let's try to get back at motivation. What motivates us to do that? Let's come back to you, Kent. What's behind this business of the American dream, of an ever-increasing standard of living? You know, this is what we tend to expect, isn't it?
Well, in our type of society, the way it's structured, even economically, the primary motivation in selling and so forth is covet. We're taught to covet, and that's the way our society operates.
All right. You get in advertising. The whole point of advertising is to increase desire. In fact, to convince us to buy what we don't need. So this whole business of covetousness is involved here. We tend to want more and more, more than we really need. Simply because we have this American dream that you're supposed to increase your standard of living. Okay, what else is behind this kind of thing? In fact, if you just ask yourself, what is it that advertisers appeal to? You get some of the motivation, don't you? Steve, do you have your hand up?
Yes. Material possessions are bound to earn more work.
All right. Your motivation then is to improve your worth, your self-worth, your self-image, which means, and in many ways, that involves to improve your reputation. You don't want to be low man on the totem pole, so you have to keep up with the Joneses. Otherwise, they look down at you and say, look at that person, you're making it. You know. Which really means that you have an appeal very often to pride. Let's take some concrete element in the things for which we spend money. I mean, we've talked about homes, we've talked about cars. Let's talk about cars. That's a pretty good subject to talk about with regard to motivation. What kinds of things are we asked to think about, and what motivations are provided for us with regard to cars? Advertising, or what have you, you know, in conversations with one another. How we feel about our neighbors, etc. Sometimes you have sexuality used, you know, and it doesn't always appeal to us in terms of sexuality. In other words, we don't go out and buy the cars advertised because we want to make it with some girls. At least I don't. That's my opinion. I hope you married men don't. And I hope you single men have higher kind of a standard. But the sexuality appeals to what with regard to those to whom the appeal is not direct? What does it try and say to you? Yeah, new image, prestige, yeah, and a good life. This is a good life. You want a good life, don't you? Yeah.
Well, power.
Power? Power is another motivation. Competitiveness? Let's put it down. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when one person on a block buys a certain kind of car, then somehow similar kinds of cars begin springing up in the rest of the block. You know? Huh?
There are more practical motivations, such as fuel economy.
All right. The desire to economize. In regard to fuel, if you're thinking of a car. If you're thinking of a car, of course, the motive is to gain some kind of transportation. And part of the problem in these other things has to do with going beyond the essential purpose of what you're spending your resources for. So instead of spending the resources just for transportation, you're spending your resources for all kinds of options that you add to the car to make it look better, so that other people will look at it and say, "Well, it's a beautiful looking car. They must be doing well in that thing." Or in terms of conveniences, we're very, very often we're motivated by laziness, really. Comfort. That's another part of it.
Security.
All right. Safety would be. See, we've got a mixture of things here. What else?
About one last 2 years with the paycheck system that was by American.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good.
The whole idea that in a depressed economy, consumers have a responsibility to buy. If you don't, then you don't get that.
And part of this then results in, on the one hand, built-in obsolescence that you get in various ways, including model changes, which of course date your car, and people look at you and say, "You know, that person can't afford a new car, because here's the way a new car looks now, and that's the way that one looks." And part of it has to do with this whole business of wanting constantly to have new things, because it makes us feel good to have new things. You know, the old syndrome, when you're down in the dump, go out and buy a new hat. Very often, the motive is to get over depression, get over bad feelings. You know, buy something new, and somehow that lifts your spirit. Huh?
Tie a couple of them together, and the case for one thing stronger. If you say economy, that's true, but I read the article about the most recent trend out of Detroit. I think it has been eclipsed for a while, the new economy. But now, I guess, the big seller in the last month has been the new car.
All right, and there are various reasons for that, right? In some cases, we have needs with regard to size of family. I must confess, the last car we got was a Toyota Corolla Tercel. It was a pretty small car. We would have had difficulty with our three children with that kind of car. So sometimes your motivation is to provide your family with transportation. All kinds of ramifications in these things, you see. Or the motivation may be safety. Some people are really afraid of the smaller cars, and some of them are not very safe, I must confess. That was a factor in our thinking when we bought the Tercel, on which we tried to economize. And I learned how to bargain, by the way, with people. In my old age, I've gotten more bold, so I've become quite a dicker. But anyway, then, two, what you have is the fact that the price of gasoline has come down. A lot of people are taking advantage of that. But that has some other factors in it, doesn't it? In terms of selfishness. For example, there's no concern about using up non-renewable resources as it now stands. Or there's not no concern about taking more of one's share of gasoline than one ought to take. If it's available, and you can afford it, then why not ride in, talk about comfort, you know, why not ride in this plush car? It gives you an awful lot of comfort. Well, we could think about other things. We could take thinking about cars, but you could think about homes in this connection. You can think about clothes in this connection. You can think about appliances and furnishings in the home. You can think about entertainment. I mean, the various things we spend money on. And it's an interesting thing. We don't, very often what happens is that we don't stop to think as to what's motivating us. You know, we're not analytical about that. We have a gut feeling that this is what we want. And it may involve a mixture of good and bad motives. You know? And all the time, you see, we're saying we're being Christ-like. And we're being godlike, and we're operating out of the love ethic, etc. And that may or may not be true, because you know, a lot of us are affected by these things. A lot of us are affected by advertising much more than we realize.
It's like cosmetics.
Cosmetics is another area, tremendous amount of money spent on cosmetics. Entertainment, of course, is another big area on which tremendous amounts of money are spent. That's why entertainers get such huge salaries. Junk foods, I mean, in terms of food, just think in terms of food. You know, what do you really need? What should you really have? And what do you buy beyond that? And it's amazing, and I say this generally, I include myself, it's amazing how materialistic and how hedonistic we tend to be. You know, we look down our noses at materialists and say, he's a materialist. But how about all the labor-saving devices that we have in our homes? Isn't that materialism, you know? Everything has to be done by electricity now, which again has to do with energy and the use of non-renewable resources in some cases. Or in terms of hedonism, you know, what gives us pleasure? And there are an awful lot of things we do to get pleasure from it. So it's very interesting to get engaged in this sort of thing with regard to our use of material resources, some of which, of course, are far removed from this, from what we saw in Luke 16:1-9. I mean, they have nothing to do with our eschatological goals. They have to do, rather, with this earth and this body and the flesh instead of the spirit and God and eternity. So that's, in fact, there's a tremendous dichotomy between these two in the Christian church. Okay, now let's do some circumstantial analysis. These things overlap, circumstantial analysis simply involves asking the questions that I indicated to you. How do I use my resources? That means laying out your budget and asking now, what do I devote to this? And what do I devote to this? What do I devote to this? What am I doing in these various areas with the money I devote to them? And Jane and I operate on a budget. We learned very soon in our lives that if we didn't, particularly when we were very hard up, we wouldn't be able to find a dime if we needed it. In fact, one day, what got us onto this was that one day when I had to commute from New Jersey to seminary in New York, had commutation money, and I assumed that Jane would have it, so I asked for some. It wasn't there. I was in real trouble. So from then on, we made out a budget to find out exactly where the money was and what we were spending it for, and to have resources for those things that are actual necessities. And then the second question is, are the motives I have, whatever they may be, good or bad, being realized in the way in which I handle my resources? Now, by the way, Sider gives, in his book to which he alluded on 182 following, what he calls some practical suggestions in which he looks at various elements in the budget. Now, he's moving toward application in this material. He isn't dividing it up as we do, so he doesn't have the same concerns that we have, but he is indicating certain areas. For example, how do I spend money for my food? You know, what am I really buying with my food money? How much of it is really necessary? How much of it is helpful? Contributes to my health, it ought to be a concern. What can I do without? What do I really need? And what goes beyond need? This whole matter of energy consumption. You know, where do I keep my thermostat? Do I use my own car when I could use public transportation, or carpools, or ride a bicycle, or walk, or what have you? Could dishwashing become a family time instead of buying a dishwasher, spending money on a dishwasher, and using electricity for a dishwasher? This whole attitude toward commercials, toward your house and what kind of house you ought to buy and what you ought to do with your house, what you do with regard to non-renewable resources, For example, do you or don't you resist obsolescence with regard to the way you spend your money? Do you share tools when you can share tools, or you go buy them? Kitty and I are talking about sharing a used riding mower. Gene helped me mow my lawn with the other day. So that, how about clothes? Do I try to keep up with the fashions? Do I throw things out before they wear out? What's my answer toward clothes? Et cetera. You know, this involves what we call circumstantial analysis. Where we really focus on what we're doing with our money. Okay, is there anything you want to say about that? Maybe you want to share with us some things that came out of the process, if you followed this process with regard to your own self-analysis. Did you get some insights into what you're doing, of which you weren't aware by doing this?
One thing I noticed in comparing my motivations with others' motivations, for example, when I left home for college, when I'd come back, I noticed a little bit more food in the refrigerator, and I became rather skeptical about my fourth year away from home, especially with regard to electric utensils like candles and things. And working on this in my senior year of college, very skeptical at motivations through advertising. So I asked my mother why she bought all these electric utensils. And it's because of her arthritis.
Yeah.
She just can't do things with the rent. And I thought, well, my goodness, here I was condemning her for all the things she had in her house.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there'd be no way I could buy that and justify it. But she couldn't open a can without that electric can. There's no way. So I said, Mom, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And it really made me think that motivations for me and motivations for my brother or sister really may or may not be the same.
Exactly. That's your situation, Alan. So you can't generalize about these things. That's why you have to ask, ultimately, what are my motives? And I wouldn't be concerned about my neighbor's motives, you know. So much, that throws you off the track. What are my motives? My neighbor's motives and situation may be different. So what may be a matter of necessity here in order just to live, to function, for one, may on the other hand be for someone else a matter just of comfort, not necessity, etc. Now, that tends to address this element. Now, here in circumstantial analysis, you would ask with regard to motives, are these motives being carried out in what I do? Now, in the case of your mother, the motive would have to do with simply being able to function. And in that case, the motives are being carried out by the purchase of these particular appliances, and what we would call gadgets, where in some other case, if one bought those gadgets, well, the motives would be different. Maybe business, or just plain comfort, convenience. Okay, any other insights with regard to this kind of thing?
I'm looking at his situation and the idea that it's okay to have a lot of capital. I've been struggling with exactly what is capital. For instance, someone who has a business has a Cadillac, and they say they need that because of the kind of business that they work with and which they do. Is that or is that not capital? And I assume it's even a very vague area hard to deal with.
No. Now, some people justify what they do on the basis of the motivation that they need to do that in order to carry on their work and make more resources, to have more resources to give. And that involves cars, it involves a number of other factors that have to do with status, status symbols. One has to ask, you know, what is your motive? Because sometimes we delude ourselves. We claim that our motive is one thing, whereas it's actually something else. It may not be that we need that, you know, to do our business. Now, of course, it's a matter of judgment in all these things, you understand. So but then one has to be willing to make the judgment, whatever that judgment may be. If you have reservations and say, well, I'm going to look at this thing in such a way so I come out on top with regard to prestige or comfort or what have you, then of course the judgment is going to be colored by that. But if you're open to judge yourself, evaluate yourself in whatever way you ought to be evaluated, fairly, honestly, and squarely, then one has to ask, what are my motivations? And if my motivations are to make more resources, if I don't really care a boot as to whether I have a Cadillac or a Chevrolet or what have you, looking within, I don't really care, and I'm doing this only to make more resources, to have more resources to give, not to use for myself now, but to give, then I can see where a person might go that way. Some people think of those terms, and they think in terms of the kind of house they buy or the kind of neighborhood they buy into because of the implications for their business association. So what happens here is that there's no black and white in these things. All kinds of factors involved. Now, another thing that you raised in regard to circumstances here would have to do with the business of capital, would have to do with how much insurance should I buy? How much should I put away for my future? How much should I save? Things of that sort. Because, of course, those things, on the one hand, are not meeting needs. I mean, people are dying now because their needs aren't being met. So if I buy a lot of life insurance, and I'm paying the life insurance, that means that I'm really taking that money away, at least potentially, from miles of people who are hungry. Or if I put too much into my future, I'm doing the same thing. Or if I engage in savings too much, I'm doing the same thing. On the other side of the coin is, and of course some people, as you know, don't believe in life insurance or planning ahead. They say you simply trust the Lord. The other side of the coin is, of course, if you don't make plans and something happens, then of course you leave yourself in the hands of other people to take care of, such as your children or society or what have you. And then, how just is that? How right is that? So, one wrestles with these things. Of course, the way in which I've tried to, and I'm now tending to move toward application here, which you have to put on that board if we get there. One of the things that I think of is that I think I ought to be responsible for myself. And I don't think that if I trust the Lord, that will guarantee that I won't end up with a long illness that will be costly. This involves another area. So I try to provide for myself in a fairly modest way, as a matter of fact, but on the basis that the money that's left then can be given. The substantial amount of it can be given to God's work. So if it isn't given now, it'll be given later. And Jesus was right, the poor will always be with you. That doesn't let us off the hook. But that means that, you know, down the line, the poor people need to be fed yet, or what have you. So there are various sides to that kind of thing. So there are many aspects. It's interesting to go down one's budget with this in mind, including the use of what you do with budget money. Now, how high do you keep your thermometer, your thermostat, for example, with regard to money you set aside for utilities? Are you conscientious in turning off lights when you don't need them? Now, I've seen some people just light up every light in the house, and they're in one room, but all the lights are lit, and it doesn't bother me. The only issue is, can I pay for it? Of course, that means, can I take money away from other things to which I ought to be giving money and put it into my utility bill? So there are all kinds of things that are involved in this. I kind of was going rapidly here, and we're going to need to move on. But you see something of what's involved in this aspect. Now, the implementation aspect would have to do with looking at these areas and asking oneself, are there other things I could do that would involve saving resources? Now, Jane and I have found that we get along fairly well with a thermostat set at 64. Now, we wouldn't have believed it. And had you told us several years ago you could set your thermostat at 64 and survive, we would have said, in particular Jane would have said, because it bothers her more than it bothers me, no way. but that's what we do. As over against, you know, 65 or 68 or 70 or 72, what have you. So those are the, you know, those are the alternatives. We're looking for alternatives. What are the alternatives? To save resources. And we're not yet talking about giving resources to someone else. Of course, you can save them and still keep them for yourself. Either spend them on something else for yourself or simply put them in savings and they never get to those in need. So we're talking at this stage simply about saving your resources in order to be able to have more resources to give to those in need. Okay. Now, let's move to the third phase, which is this one here. Now, what we need to do in this, by the way, as I indicated here, we need to be concerned about three areas. We've been talking primarily about this area, analyzing ourselves. We have to analyze what the needs are, for which we have some responsibility as Christians, and what the best means are to meet those needs. And that's also part of this process of analysis. And you could, you could go through this, these phases with regard to both of those. And incidentally, Sider does some good work in these areas. For example, you have to get at the whole issue of various kinds of needs that need to be met, such as world hunger, such as housing, such as evangelism, such as medical needs, etc., etc., agricultural needs, all kinds of things. Then you need to make a judgment as to how much of your resources you ought to contribute at all. And by the way, Sider does some interesting work in that area with regard to what he calls a graduated tithe on pages 175 following, by way of determining how much his family ought to give. In other words, he carries through this process on the basis of trying to come up with a certain amount of money to give. And he doesn't use the tithe in any legalistic way and indicates that this ought not to be applied legalistically by anybody, but he uses a graduated tithe. He begins with the poverty level for his family, and he gives 10% of that level. And he illustrates here the first $8,000 would be poverty level for his family, gives 10%. The next 1,000, he gives 15%. The next 1,000, he gives 20%. The next 1,000, he gives 25%. The next 1,000, 30%. The next 1,000, 35%. So on an income of $13,000, $2,050 is given. Because it's substantially higher than the tithe, by the way. And then he has another scale on the next page. And this one climbs up to $26,000. And it involves giving 100% of the final 1,000, so that it means on the basis of an income of 26,000, 14,850 is kept for personal expenditures and savings, and 11,150 is given to matters of the kingdom. Well, I tell you, even if people in the church tithe, the church would be giving probably about four times as much as it is. If the church did this, who knows what effect it would have on the world? Now, let me make it clear. Not that I have already attained this. But it's interesting, when you start thinking radically, which is, I suppose, what we need to do. So what's true here? It's interesting what happens in terms of the amount that you find. Now, there are arguments about these things, you know. Feel free to leave here. There are arguments about these things. And Margaret has a work assignment. Should you take a vacation or not? If you take a vacation, what kind of vacation should you take? That's most responsible in terms of use of resources. And my wife and I began discussing that. You know, should you take money to see your children? What are your responsibilities to your children? This is not an easy matter, my friend. You have begun to see. But it needs to be done. We aren't doing this kind of thing. That's why a lot of people are willing to settle for a percentage, about 10%, say. That's the easy way out. That's the path of least resistance. When you pay your 10% and you're scot-free, you're home free. But I think in our affluent society, 10% is not what God really requires of us to fulfill this truth of 1500. Well, does this give you some feel for the process that you go through? If we got church members thinking in these terms, I think something would happen, really. I really do. In this area and other areas that we need to be sure. Paul?
As far as the next lesson, because of our possible time limitations, might be good for us just to choose one of those three in situational analysis and follow it all the way through, say, needs, and maybe the means to this.
Yeah. I'm not sure that these three categories always apply to every problem. But sometimes they're intermingled. But I would, if that helps you to focus in on one thing, fine. What we're doing here is hoping that collectively we'll come up with things, though we're going off in different directions. Collectively, we'll come up with something that's helpful to all of us. That's our focus. So. I'm not so much interested in uniformity. In fact, I think diversity is helpful. This is the kind of dialogue, not exactly this, I mean, we ought to have more dialogue, but this is the kind of dialogic work that ought to be going on in the church with regard to trying to come up with decisions of this sort, as Bertrand Rasmussen indicated. And not enough dialogue is taking place. Now, who discusses budgets, their personal budgets in the church? Do you have anybody? No. That's a private matter, right? So each of us is making his own decisions in his own little corner, okay? without the help of a community that will perhaps help us to see motives in what we're doing that we don't realize are there, help us analyze our circumstances, give us alternatives they've thought of that we don't know. This is what ought to be going on in the church. And I hope that what we're doing will encourage you to encourage your people as you go out to ministry. To do this kind of thing, that way kind of come up with decisions that accord with biblical perspectives and truth. It'll change our lives and change the life of the church if we do. Okay, we'll see you then on Tuesday. This is our last day of the week. Yeah, hand in those papers as you go out, and have a good weekend. And we'll look forward to that interesting discussion on nuclear weapons. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.